Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Works fans Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Work in Progress. I'm Tom Alexander, and as always, I am joined by my good friend and podcast partner. It is Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. You know, we've had a number of very interesting people on recently to talk about pay equity and compensation. We've taken some pretty deep dives. Mm-hmm. I expect we're going to be taking an equally deep dive today.
I hope I don't get the bends, you know?
Yes, that's right. This is going to be, very, very deep. Jacques Cousteau deep.
Exactly.
The barnacle in the larval stage extends its foot to sift small organisms from the water.
Anyway, we're going to be speaking with Brian Levine, Mercer's global pay equity leader and a partner in Mercer's workforce strategy and analytics practice. And as you know, their team sent us several statistical deep dives, speaking of deep dives, into the very complex but vitally important topic of pay equity. So hopefully, Tom, we're able to digest it and we'll be able to ask Brian a set of cogent questions.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. But, you know, that is the plan.
After. Yeah, if not, we're going to have to work out a signal to bring us up to the surface very quickly.
Yes, yes. Yeah, when you start seeing the bubbles and then, you know, then the bubbles stop. Yes. That's a problem.
Yes.
Yeah. On that note, we'll move right along. It is Brian Levine coming up next right here on Work in Progress. Now these words.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it, 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Tell me who's been, who been you?
Tell the truth. Today, we're joined by Brian Levine, Mercer's global pay equity leader and a partner in Mercer's workforce strategy and analytics practice. Brian has more than 20 years of consulting experience in people analytics, working with company data to identify the drivers of rewards and turnover, as well as significant links between human capital practices and business performance. Brian speaks with us today from New York. Brian, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Please say hello to my podcast partner, Charles Epstein.
Hi, Charles.
Hey, Brian. Thanks so much for taking the time. Much appreciated. I was browsing your LinkedIn page just before we started this, and it says that Brian is often quoted in the media. Notable quotes appear in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, or the Washington Post. Of course, now you're going to have to add Work in Progress. But of course, that's a full interview. So even more impressive, Brian.
I will get to that immediately. Thank you, Charles.
Yes, if not sooner. Thanks. Anyway, again, thanks so much for joining us. How's New York these days?
Yeah, no storms this week, so things are okay.
Okay, good. Yeah, born and bred. I hadn't been there in some time. I was up several months ago, so it was nice to be back and nice to see that things are, at least at that point, returning to normal. I don't know if that's the case now, but anyway, it was nice to see. Brian, over the past several years, pay equity assessments have evolved. What have been the major changes? what has been driving these changes? I assume DEI is a major driver.
Yeah, DEI is indeed a major driver. Employers are looking to ensure that they're doing the right thing by their employees. I think that is escalated now with, what is, I think a strengthening, dramatically strengthening new war for talent. Employees are explicitly asking for information as to how the organization is promoting equity. They're looking for greater transparency. And, we're also seeing that activist investors are pushing companies for information related to DEI and equity. So, pay equity, DEI, they fall squarely in the ESG space for organizations. So compliance continues to be a driver, Charles. But, I would say, this need to be proactive and reporting is really what we've seen driving a renewed interest in this area in the last few years.
What critical process refinements have driven the greatest impact?
Yeah, a few things. In many organizations, I would say, leading organizations focused on this area have integrated pay equity analysis into the annual review. Now, the timing might vary. It might not always be that the pay equity review is done aligned with the merit cycle because there's a lot that happens at year end. But generally, there's a point in time in the year when pay equity is looked at and adjustments are identified and considered. And that regular review works to ensure that companies are really living to the promise of equity. Also on the notion of refinement, I would say that, what we've seen over the last few years is a progression from what has been a compliance process, an assurance that legally risk is minimized, that the most egregious issues person by person in terms of alignment of those individuals on compensation to norms, that those things are addressed. And what's happened over the last few years is that there's been a imperative to consider adjustments to drive real change beyond the person level to ensure that if there is a gap between women and men or between people of color and whites, that those issues are addressed. So, a significant process refinement, I would say, where we Mercer have been very engaged over the last few years is ensuring that dollars are spent with impact.
Mm. I suppose one way to define it or describe it is you're moving from being defensive to being more proactive.
Yes, absolutely. Agreed.
Describe, if you would, for our listeners, Mercer's pay equity process, Brian.
Yeah, we go through three steps, broadly defined, Charles, in doing this kind of review. The first is data collection. We're pulling information on compensation. And, there it's not just base pay. It's also total compensation to provide an all-in look. Obviously, we're pulling information on gender and race ethnicity in the U.S. And then we're pulling information on factors that can legitimately explain differences in pay. We know that role has an impact on how people are paid. We know that an individual's experience has an impact, a significant impact on pay. So we look to pull data that can ensure that we can account for those differences. And that data collection, Charles, is informed by work that we do across hundreds of companies annually. It's also informed by what companies actually track in their systems and what they deem should matter in driving pay. The second big step is a statistical analysis, where, you know, my team is generally heavily engaged providing that disciplined third party review of compensation practices. The statistical analysis is designed to allow us to link pay outcomes to those legitimate factors. How does pay vary with role? How does pay vary with experience? How does pay vary with performance? The factors that should link to compensation vis-a-vis the philosophy, those are things that we're accounting for in the analysis. And we're, you know, heavily reviewing, validating those models with the organizations that we work with. And the third big step is once those models are locked down, that's when we really turn to the equity consideration. Given that we've accounted for relevant differences, what remains, what gap exists that might be attributable to gender or race, ethnicity, and what do we do about it? How do we remediate to close those gaps?
Yeah. We associate pay equity with process fairness. In a paper you co-authored titled Achieving Pay Equity, you say that the trade-off for maintaining process fairness is its muted impact on addressing systemic pay gaps. And to close those gaps, you generally recommend a bottom-up approach. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by a bottom-up approach?
Yeah, let me separate the, for the time being, the discussion of process fairness from bottom-up. I'll link them at the end. Mm-hmm. Process fairness is this idea that at the end of the process, everybody should be considered for a pay adjustment. Women and men, both. Non-whites and whites, both. And that, I think it's easy to see. In the case where you have, let's focus on gender, women paid less than men, adjusting both women and men is going to get in the way of making progress in closing that gap. So where does process fairness come from? It comes from a, I would say compliance orientation, which has fallen off in recent years, though it's still there. We want to ensure that any pay adjustment we make is blind to gender, blind to race, ethnicity. In a pay equity analysis, at the end of it, we will identify outliers. These are individuals who seem to be paid outside of the norm. Having people paid outside of the norm is not an issue. There's only an issue if more of those people who are paid outside of the norm on the negative side are in one group or another. So what we've done is we've taken that process fairness notion. We continue to promote it, but we've kind of linked it to a more targeted idea about how to make adjustments, which is to say, if in a group, women are paid less than men, let's adjust the women who are outliers. If in a group, men are paid less than women, let's adjust the men. So there's fairness. Everybody has an opportunity to get adjusted through the process, but we've engineered the process to ensure that we are better steering the dollars to the group that is disadvantaged. And that steering can effectively close the gap. So kind of coming back now to the notion of bottom up, mm-hmm. That really links to this idea of outlier. So we close a group level gap, that's the top line, by focusing on the individuals that are most out of alignment with norms. In the disadvantaged class, if women are paid less than men, focusing on the women. We do that so that we're positioning dollars to those that, you know, again, are most out of alignment with norms, that we're not just across the board processing the same adjustment for all individuals of a given class. I think it's obvious as to why that, you know, strategy like that would not be desirable. We focus the dollars to those not only who are in the disadvantaged class, but those who are furthest removed from from what we'd expect them to be paid. So bottom up means go to the individuals to see where to spend the dollars.
Ah, I see. That makes sense. In the paper Tom mentioned, you state that the raw pay gap will not be addressed through pay equity and analysis alone. It is primarily driven by differences in the roles occupied by women and men and by employees of color and white employees, as well as other individual and situational factors, such as experience, performance, business affiliation, and location. You speak about statistical modeling of pay drivers and how that can identify root causes of pay gaps. What are some of these root causes, and how can they be more helpful in addressing these pay gaps?
Yeah, the raw pay gap has two parts, right? The raw pay gap is just average pay for one group against average pay for another. So let's just stick to the gender example for simplicity. So it's average pay for women against average pay for men. And when I say it can be broken into two parts, I mean, part of it is explained. It's explained by the fact that women and men sit in different roles and different levels of the hierarchy. That's not desirable. And that's something that companies can solve for, but it's not a pay equity issue. Once we account for the fact that women and men sit in different roles, have different experience, sit in different locations, so on and so forth, something perhaps remains, and that's the unexplained gap. And that is the pay equity issue. We address that by considering targeted pay increases to counter the issue. Now, in terms of solving both the unexplained gap and the raw gap, let me say that we can think beyond kind of these targeted pay adjustments to broader action. So, in terms of ensuring that pay equity issues don't arise, there we can look to issues like hiring. When we bring in people, are we bringing them in at equitable rates? Are we bringing in women at the same pay rates as men? Because if we're not, that will drive up gaps that we might have thought addressed through increases in the prior cycle. With regard to the raw gap, there are other analyses that can be done to say, well, look, we know we have fewer women in the top ranks. How do we change that? Is it about how we hire people into roles? Is it about how, and not the pay rate that we hire people in at, but how we hire people into roles at into higher levels versus lower levels? And, how do we promote people up? And, how good a job are we doing at retaining that talent in the senior roles? That broader look is going to be important to ensure that we can help companies close that raw gap.
Yeah. Let me just ask you quickly, when you refer to location, I'm assuming that literally means, for instance, somebody who can be, for instance, in New York or say where I am, Boca Raton, South Florida, where they're very, very different costs of living. That's what we're talking about, right? When we talk about location, that's what we're factoring into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to that point, I just wanted to make sure that was in fact the case. I'm assuming now with, I mentioned the great resignation, obviously there's a lot of churn, a lot of movement. People are going, not just from the main office to the home office, but moving, because you just have the ability these days and companies are allowing you to move and work wherever. As somebody said, it's no longer the workplace, it's the workspace. So to the extent that people are now working from just about anywhere where you could at one point work from, is this becoming more and more of a variable and something that needs to be looked into?
Well, I think companies are changing their philosophies in terms of how they're going to be recognizing location and how that is going to be impacting work. What we do in our review is we take location as a potential factor driving pay difference. To the degree that it does come in as driving pay difference, that's recognized. To the degree that companies are moving away from location and kind of broadening how they think about pay in that way, you know, not by location per se, but, you know, perhaps, you know, looking at, you know, region in a broader manner, looking at remote employees as, you know, as distinct, you know, those things would be reflected in the models that we run and appropriately taken into account.
Okay.
Our guest is Brian Levine. He's Mercer's global pay equity leader and a partner in Mercer's workforce strategy and analytics practice. Brian, at the conclusion of your paper, you state that for pay equity, the ultimate goal may be, quote, 100 cents on the dollar, but the exercise should not be turned into a numbers game. This after several pages of statistical analysis. In order to address the very large...
Brian, I'm glad you see the humor in that question.
Yeah, I get it.
In order to address the very large and highly complex issue of pay gaps, what should companies be thinking of beyond the numbers and beyond the statistical analysis or analyses? Mm.
Yeah. Well, look, I think the numbers matter. I think that's clear. You know, as organizations look at pay equity, I think there are emerging standards. The first threshold, if you will, is getting to 1% or better on all relevant margins. So, you know, whether you're looking at it by gender or race, ethnicity, you know, let's ensure for every group that gaps are within the 1% zone. Now, it doesn't mean 1% is okay, right? It doesn't mean 99 cents on the dollar is okay, but it does recognize that the data that we have tracked in our systems is incomplete. We look to, over time, build up the quality of that data to do a better job of explaining legitimate differences. And so, you know, companies can get to a better place, but the first stop is less than 1%. The second stop is statistical insignificance, or effectively zero. When we say don't make it a numbers game, I do worry about a concern about year-to-year decimal point changes in the gap. We move from 99.2 cents on the dollar to 99.4 cents or vice versa. Steady progress is important, but you know, once you get inside that 1% zone, you know, I would argue that investments relating to ensuring access to the high paid jobs, so that's moving from pay equity to career equity, is probably going to be more critical. So, you know, thinking about, you know, how you're hiring, how you can, you know, ensure greater diversity in your hiring, you know, how you're advancing, you know, what does it take to advance at your company? And, you know, so for example, do you require a college degree at some point, or, you know, a certain credential, and is that really required? And if it is required, you know, what can you do to support employees in getting access to that credential and that experience? That's going to be important. So, you know, I think there comes a point where you get pay equity to a zone where it becomes more about maintenance, and, you know, the investment naturally would move to, you know, this focus on, you know, ensuring people are in the right roles.
Yeah, by the way, I'm really glad you walked us through that, because when I saw that in your report, sort of reminded me, you know, you're going through all this deep analysis and don't worry about the numbers, more than the numbers. Reminded me sort of taking a cooking class, and you're following a very elaborate recipe in 25 minutes, and the chef says, but it's not about the ingredients. But I digress.
I know.
An analysis of the internal labor market that your team shared with us predicts employee exits based on various factors. Pay had a more modest impact than supervision, when managers are further removed from their supervisees, it resulted in greater turnover. The other factor that had an impact in employee exits was mobility and insufficient onboarding and training. Today, with organizations more decentralized than ever, a trend that's likely only to grow, what could be done to improve retention when compensation becomes a less effective lever?
Yeah. So the analysis you're talking about is, something we call internal labor market analysis. It's looking at a particular company and running statistical models to understand the unique drivers of an outcome for that company. So, you know, what you're referring to is an aspect of that work focused on turnover, where, you know, we for that company looked to see what were the critical drivers of retention. And in that case, what we found is that pay was impactful, but it was less impactful than the supervisory relationships. That's not a universal. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's pay first and foremost. Sometimes it's employee experience. You know, different roles are linked to different levels of exit. What I would say is, and this, by the way, links to, you know, effective management of DEI too, is that it's important to really understand at your own organization, what are the critical steps that you can take to improve retention group by group. So in the case that you, you referenced, supervision was a critical factor. The quality of the supervisory relationship, I'll say broadly, was a critical factor. But what was really interesting is when we looked at that effect by gender and by race ethnicity, it was much stronger for women. It was much stronger for people of color than it was for men or for whites. Mm. So what we were hearing is from these diverse populations is that they were critically focused on the quality of the supervisory relationship. So not only is an organization through that information able to focus on a root cause driver of retention and the value proposition, but they were also through the same steps able to improve their position on diversity.
One last question, Brian. There's growing pressure on organizations to disclose their pay equity situation. What can, and in your experience, what are companies doing to be more transparent vis-a-vis compensation gaps? And what do you recommend they do if they want to be more proactive?
Yeah, I think that the critical pieces of a disclosure now are the following. First, where the company stands on pay equity, accounting for relevant factors. Are we paying individuals fairly? And, you know, to be able to state not only that the process is in place, but where the organization is at. And again, 99 cents on the dollar across all relevant dimensions, an emerging standard, getting to insignificance, a better outcome. And, you know, organizations that are getting ready to consider that disclosure, they are conducting analysis and making proactive adjustments to get inside that zone. The second part of the disclosure, though, has to relate to this other thing we were talking about, the raw pay gap, or what I'll call career equity. You know, this notion that people might be paid fairly within a role, but maybe they don't have equal access to the high paying roles. It's a natural question that anybody would have upon hearing, well, you know, we pay people fairly once we account for relevant factors. Well, you know, do you also provide access to these high earning opportunities on an equal basis? So on that front, to be able to speak to representation, where is the organization, you know, not just at the C-suite and board level, but where is the organization in the senior management ranks in terms of building up representation, and how the organization, given that most are not there, how is the organization looking to improve its position? What steps is it taking in terms of hiring diverse talent, in terms of supporting talent, providing relevant experience for that talent, to ensure that it is over time going to achieve progress on that front, and to be able to share goals to say, you know, we're at this point now, here's where we expect to be 3 years hence. That shouldn't be a number that comes out of nowhere. It should be based on, you know, a disciplined analysis of the data, knowing how much we hire, how much we promote in a given year, the expected retention, here's where we, and the actions that we intend to take, here's where we think we can get to within a few years. That also would be an important part of the disclosure. And I think being also transparent about as much as possible the specifics of the programs in place to improve that diversity of representation, I think that also is going to be important in such a communication.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for taking time out today and joining us, Brian. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it too.
Brian Levine was our guest. He's Mercer's global pay equity leader and a partner in Mercer's workforce strategy and analytics practice. Brian Levine spoke to us today from New York. This is Work in Progress. Back in a moment.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it, 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Wrapping things up on Work in Progress, along with Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. Deep dive accomplished, Charles.
That was actually quite an interesting and, in fact, a fun conversation. Fun and pay equity probably don't all the time go together in the same sentence. But, you know, Brian is just so cogent and walked us through so many aspects of this. And you had asked him at one point, you know, we went through all of those reports, waded through all of that heavy statistical analysis, only to learn one of your papers that's more than the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, nothing to see here.
Right.
More than the numbers. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because in speaking with Brian, that's very much the case. And you really do realize that the work that he and his team does, the analysis they do, is very much the beating heart of the organization. It touches so many areas, from basic compliance to DEI, to the ability to retain top people, to even give people opportunity to higher paying jobs. And as we know, a diverse workforce, many studies support this, a diverse workforce is a higher performing workforce. So so much of his work is so important and is the beating heart of many organizations.
Yeah, no, it really is. It certainly is. And we thank Brian Levine for coming on again today. We really appreciate it. This is Work in Progress. He's Charles Epstein. I'm Tom Alexander. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between, with award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/workinprogress. That's worldatwork.org/workinprogress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.